You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show...
What was the bad war was Iraq. We're going to get out of there as fast as we can. And the good war was Afghanistan. And it does seem to me that they have been careless about the implications of the very serious fighting in Iraq.
From Mosul to Taksim to Sao Paulo, we'll review the day's top news stories with Phil Clark and Matthew Jameson here in the studio. Then we'll hear from James Montagu about his new book, reflecting on the most magnificent victory in the history of international football, Australia 31, American Samoa 0.
If a football story from the Pacific comes out on the 10 o'clock news in Britain, you know that something serious has happened, or something interesting has happened. And I always remember the coach afterwards who said, he gave a brilliant quote, he said, I don't know why they wanted to score so many goals.
Later in the show, we'll be talking books with Fleur MacDonald, and we'll be checking in as well with our man in Sarajevo, and if you're incredibly lucky, playing you a bit of music. That's all coming up right here on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, right now. A typically action-packed hour ahead then, but before all of that, Jonathan Wheatley has the latest world news.
Ukraine's interior minister has today accused Russia of allowing three tanks and other military vehicles to cross the border into Ukraine to help pro-Russian separatists there. Russia did not immediately respond to the accusations, but Reuters correspondents say they saw three tanks in the border town Ashnitsnia in east Ukraine. Meanwhile, Russian natural gas exporter Gazprom has said it will halt supplies to Ukraine if it fails to pay off $1.95 billion of its gas debts. The United States says it's ready to help Iraq to tackle the Islamist militants who've now seized control of two major cities. President Barack Obama said that he's looking at all the options in helping the Iraqi government face down the growing insurgency. Obama said the United States was prepared to take military action when its national security interests were threatened. After moving in on Mosul, prompting 500,000 people to flee, the rebels now control large parts of Tikrit, less than 100 miles from the capital Baghdad. They have already held Fallujah since January. Well, Scott Lucas is from EA Worldview.
So the question is, will they make a move further down the highway and try to attack Samarra today? And also, keep an eye up on the north in what we call Iraqi Kurdistan. Will they make a move on Kirkuk, which is one of the key oil cities in Iraq, or will they accept the fact that that might anger Iraqis Kurds, and so that's another red line that they won't cross, at least for the moment?
Here, the anarchic British comic actor Rick Mayall, who died suddenly this week, aged just 56, suffered an acute cardiac event at his home, his widow has just said today. Mayall, who revolutionised television sitcoms with the young ones in the 1980s, died on Monday. Anti-World Cup protesters have clashed with police in Sao Paulo on Thursday, just hours before the opening match of the tournament kicks off. A few dozen protesters clashed with police about 7 miles from the Arena Corinthians Stadium, which will host the Brazil-Croatia opener in 3 hours' time at 20:00 GMT tonight. Tear gas flew as police moved in to arrest one protester who they sprayed in the eyes with what appeared to be pepper spray. 5 people have been injured. Meanwhile, FIFA have said that Brazil should have limited the number of host cities to 8 to make it easier to host the competition. Rogério Simões, executive director of Africa magazine, says the government's decision to increase the number of host cities to 12 was political.
FIFA wanted the World Cup to have between 8 and 10 host cities only, because the more cities that you have, the more complicated the whole thing is. But because of political reasons, the government has decided to take the World Cup to places like Manaus in the Amazon and Cuiabá in the center of Brazil, and the number of host cities that we have today is 12.
And finally, police in the United States say a marijuana smoker has been arrested in Arizona after shooting at the moon with a handgun and wrestling with officers who were called by his girlfriend to subdue him. Police went to a home in Prescott Valley, about 85 miles north of Phoenix, where the man was still high, insisting he'd just seen Halley's Comet. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We shall be back right after this.
vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. Este é Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, near enough, which will be 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Dr. Phil Clark, reader in international politics at SOAS, and Matthew Jameson, consultant fellow at the defence think tank RUSI, both here in London. We'll start tonight with Iraq, where events have moved with extraordinary speed over the last few days. The Islamist militants of ISIL have seized Mosul and Tikrit. Hundreds of thousands of refugees from both cities have struggled to keep pace with the fleeing soldiers supposed to be protecting them. The only significant counterattack, the securing of Kirkuk, has been done by Kurdish Peshmerga. ISIL are now threatening to march on Baghdad. Earlier, Robert Fox, defence editor of London's Evening Standard, had this to say.
I think ISIS has scared them to death, really, and it calls into question the Obama philosophy and security posture. Remember, in his first election campaign, what was the bad war was Iraq. We're going to get out of there as fast as we can. And they did in 2011. And the good war was Afghanistan. And it does seem to me that they have been careless about the implications of the very serious fighting in Iraq, as well as that in Syria. And they now, in the hands of ISIS, are one and the same thing.
As Robert Fox from the Evening Standard. Phil Clark from SOAS, I'll start with you. Iraq's ambassador to the US was earlier today reported as saying that the integrity of Iraq is now in question. Is he right?
I think so. It seems a country that's in grave danger of fragmentation, that two major cities have fallen to ISIL. Another city has fallen to these Kurdish forces. Big questions over al-Maliki's government in Baghdad. This is a country that seems on the brink of falling apart.
Matthew Jameson from RUSI, I guess I'll put to you a similar question. We're talking about allegedly a country which apparently can't defend two of its most important cities from a non-state militia equipped largely with small arms. At what point do you start to call a country incapable of seeing off a threat like that a failed state?
Well, it is already a failed state. It's in the top five failed states in the world. It's absolutely shocking what's going on in Iraq in such a quick speed. There were 30,000 soldiers in Mosul, and only 800 rebel Islamic fundamentalist fighters from ISIS. And those 30,000 soldiers just didn't do anything. They turned away and they fled. So also, in the parliament in Baghdad, there's about only 100 and something MPs turned up today out of 300 and something for a vote of the emergency powers. There is no confidence probably now in the Maliki government. And I would not be surprised if the Maliki government is toppled fairly rapidly, actually.
Toppling of the Maliki government, we are getting a bit ahead of ourselves here. We should probably stick to what we know, although events are moving completely quick, very, very quickly. That would return Iraq to civil war, wouldn't it?
Well, it's basically in a state of civil war.
Exactly, yeah. To the extent that it already isn't.
Yeah, I mean, you know, about 1,000 people died last month in Iraq. About 1,000 people have been dying each month in Iraq for the last 2 years. 500,000 people had to flee Mosul in one day. There's a huge humanitarian refugee situation going on. So it is basically already in a state of civil war between the Sunni and the Shia. It's just a question of just how much more, how more terrible it's going to become.
Phil Clark, just before we came on air, President Obama was reported as saying that he was looking at all the options and made what can only have been a pointed reference to the use of military action if he thought it was in America's interest. At this point, is there anything America could do if it wanted to? And how would you even begin to sell that to the American public?
I think Obama's got an almost impossible situation on his hands. He's got very little political will within his own country for any kind of military intervention. The US's strategy in Iraq to date clearly has failed. I think, as has already been mentioned, the Iraqi army basically has fled in the face of these recent attacks, which is a sign of how poor the US's engagement with the Iraqi army has been, that really they gutted this institution. You're now seeing an army full of very poorly trained fighters. So all of this points to the fact that the US has really caused more chaos than it has given order in Iraq in recent years. Mm-hmm. So there's not a track record here. I see Obama's talking about potential drone attacks. He's looking at trying to prop up the al-Maliki government. Really, all options are being thrown on the table, but no real sense of coherence to any of this, I don't think.
If America can't do anything or won't do anything or is constrained from doing anything by domestic political reality, is there a chance that, I mean, if you're trying to run a semi-serious country in this region, this is now starting to look incredibly unpleasant. You basically have two failed states adjacent to each other in Syria and Iraq. You have a multi-headed war raging across both of them. At what point does a country like Turkey or Iran decide we're going to take an interest in this?
Well, that's a very good question, because just before I came in, there are already comments coming out of Tehran. The new president, Hassan Rouhani, remember, of course, Iran is a predominantly Shia Muslim country. And he's saying he will not tolerate any kind of Sunni Islamic extremism. So you could very well see some kind of intervention from Iran. Another Iran-Iraq war, heavens above. There's also no real border now between Syria and Iraq. And this is
barely one between Iraq and Iran.
And there's, you know, the lack of a border between Syria and Iraq is what IS is trying to create. It wants a Sunni militant enclave straddling both Iraq and Syria. So you could actually see all sorts of regional actors becoming involved in this. It's a mess, and it is a damning indictment of the decision that was taken in 2003 and the complete lack of post-war planning. I was someone who supported the removal of Saddam Hussein, and I now look back and I see that it was a terrible, terrible mistake in foreign policy, and it's a catastrophe.
The removal of Saddam Hussein and what happened afterwards, you alluded there, or both of you did indeed, to the disbandment of the Iraqi army by Ambassador Bremer very shortly after the invasion of Iraq. I can remember being in Baghdad circa May 2003, and it was already becoming apparent that sort of large numbers of young, unemployed, irritated men with access to weapons was not a helpful thing to have when you were trying to rebuild a country. One of the bizarre subplots of the last 48 hours, and everything that we've seen and read in the last 48 hours has been bizarre, but you have Kurdistan's Peshmerga stepping up to secure Kirkuk. Now, I've asked or thought this about the Kurdish semi-state many times over the last 10 years, really. At what point are they going to be tempted to say, and Phil, I'll come to you with this one first, are they going to be tempted to say, this Iraq thing is going nowhere, we are going to set up shop on our own?
I think this is part of this fragmentation idea that we were talking about before, that when you have a state that is as fragile as Iraq clearly is, a range of other actors with interests in the country can act in very unpredictable ways, and I think that's what we've been seeing from the Kurds in the last 24 or 48 hours, a sense of opportunity. They've been looking for an opening to increase their sense of autonomy and to expand the kind of realm of their rights, and here's an opportunity to do so. And if it means using violence to do that, well, this is the recourse that they'll use.
They could probably quite reasonably suggest as well, if the Crimeans are allowed to have a referendum on their future, what's stopping us?
Well, yeah, I mean, what we're seeing here geopolitically is, it's fascinating, because this is the unraveling of the Sykes-Picot settlement in the Middle East, which was an artificially enforced construction and redesign of the borders in the Middle East, which has given rise to the modern Middle East that we know. But all these states were actually artificial. Iraq's not really a proper nation state. And so the statement that came out of ISIS this afternoon was, we are now undoing the Sykes-Picot settlement, and we are getting rid of these artificially constructed states, and we will bring back the Islamic Caliphate.
As far as we know about ISIL, as you pointed out, they approach these Iraqi cities with relatively small numbers of quite lightly armed men and tens of thousands allegedly professional soldiers fled before them. But are they do they have what I guess I'm trying to figure out? Do they have any backing from anybody else, anywhere else, or are they an entirely self-contained thing? And as such, can they actually hang on in the long term to a large area of territory?
Well, they've already taken a great chunk in Syria. They control a great deal of eastern Syria. They are it's complicated because they grew out of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which came in, of course, after the invasion in 2003. They don't have a major sponsor or patron such as Hezbollah has Iran. They could be getting some support in an indirect fashion from Saudi Arabia, who, of course, have been backing heavily the Sunni rebels in Syria. But no, they do not have a major sponsor as far as we know.
As has been pointed out, and the photographs are quite entertaining, if bleak irony is your thing, they're also now quite heavily equipped with American-supplied military equipment, which they've taken off the Iraqi army. Phil, another point that sort of may spur various outside players into action is the effect this is going to have on oil prices. They're up $2 a barrel today to a three-month high. At what point does that start to prey on the imaginations of outside powers?
I'm sure it's already exercising huge anxiety amongst international governments. This is an era of already inflated oil prices, economic pressures on all international governments. This comes at a very, very delicate time. And I mean, coming back to one of the issues we were just mentioning before, in the case of ISIL, that it's also been reported that they've stolen something like $500 million US dollars out of the bank in That's Mosul. Right. So if one of the issues here is this an organization that can fund itself and extend its operations, it seems like it's just self-funded itself. Yeah. It may not need an outside backer. Mm-hmm. And when you've got a state that's as fragile as Iraq is at the moment, you don't have to be a particularly coherent or even well-organized rebel or militia force to exact enormous revenge and control enormous territory. You can fill a vacuum like that very, very quickly. So I think that's one of the big concerns at the moment.
Mm. Well, at which point we should discuss the threat that ISIL were making earlier to march on Baghdad. They're approximately 100 miles away. Baghdad is a hell of a big city. Is that plausible?
Well, it is a big city of about 7 million people, but I think, quite frankly, anything's plausible in Iraq, because what we're seeing is that there's no confidence in the government. There are serious tensions and problems between the minority Sunni community and the predominantly Shia-led government of Nouri al-Maliki. And, of course, these have been manipulated very successfully by ISIS. So anything's possible, quite frankly. I think, you know, the situation in Iraq is disintegrating so fast, and it seems to have moved so quickly in the last 24 hours that anything could be possible with regards to Baghdad.
What's really interesting is when you look now at a map of the region, fluid though it clearly is, it strikes me at least as very, very hard to see, say, even 3-4 years from now, how Syria and Iraq as we currently know them could possibly still exist as single coherent entities. Might we have to brace ourselves, and Phil, I'll put this to you first, for a fairly substantial redrawing of the Middle East's borders?
I do think that's the predicament we're faced with at the moment. I think, as has been pointed out, these were quite artificial borders to begin with, but the current conflict shows that the borders really mean nothing. They don't mean anything in political terms, that they hold, they're no barrier to military operations with various forces moving backwards and forwards. These things may be drawn on a map at the moment, but they don't mean anything. That's probably going to lead to a more kind of formal dismantling of these borders quite soon, particularly when you have various religious and other types of groups straddling these borders. And if these groups, I guess, as we're seeing with the Kurds, become increasingly politically important, they may get a real say in the way that those borders are redrawn. So I think we could see fairly substantial change in the next year or two.
Matt, Matthew, you just finally, could we see an enlarged Iran, an enlarged Turkey, entire new countries where Iraq and Syria are now?
Absolutely. I mean, all bets are off, quite frankly. What we're seeing is these tremendous birth pangs of a new Middle East coming through. It's an absolute ferment and upheaval with the Arab Spring and the clash between modernity and traditional Islamic religious values. It's going through a huge change, and it will probably look very different at the end of it.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. I dare say we'll be returning to this story in the days ahead. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. I'll be back with Phil Clark and Matthew Jameson when we return.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Dr. Phil Clark, reader in international politics at SOAS, and Matthew Jameson from RUSI. We're turning now to Turkey, where 26 people are on trial accused of organising last year's protests at Gezi Park in Istanbul. The defendants face prison sentences of up to 29 years if convicted. Matthew from RUSI, Amnesty International are calling this a show trial, is it?
Absolutely. It's absolutely appalling. There are very serious concerns about the human rights situation in Turkey and the rule of law. And the current Prime Minister, Erdogan, who seems to have been there forever, he's 11 years. How much longer is this man going to hang around? He's obviously an authoritarian, power-crazed megalomaniac. He has abused his office consistently to persecute political opponents with trumped-up charges and cock and bull stories. He even tried to ban Twitter last month. I mean, the man is actually probably, unhinged. And so it's obviously a breakdown in the rule of law. And yes, I would say it's a show trial.
Phil, Erdogan clearly not getting Matthew's vote there. But you do raise a question which has occurred to me more than once as well. Erdogan's behaviour over the last couple of years, especially his authoritarian response to dissent, his sort of quite bizarre burblings about some sort of international conspiracy against Turkey. And it's never a good sign when the head of a government starts talking about an international conspiracy. He has been there for 11 years, which is far too long for anybody to be in power. Is there actually a serious possibility that he may have parted company with the plot?
That would be one explanation. I think another explanation is that he's cracking under a form of pressure he hasn't seen before, which is an internally fragmented state. There's been rumblings of a gap between the military and the executive, which is something that Erdogan hadn't had to deal with before. And he's seeing a more robust civil society and protest movement, which has gained courage, has looked around the region and seen the Arab Spring and other countries, and this frightens dictators who often get very used to operating in particular ways, and when popular opinion gets more mobilized and you see more energetic forms of protest, leaders often react in very unpredictable ways.
That story again, I suspect we will be coming back to. Finally, tonight we do have to deal with the fact that we are slightly less than 3 hours, a bit two hours 36 minutes in fact from kickoff in Brazil 2014, Brazil versus Croatia, 2.5 hours from now. Obviously, the clue is in the name World Cup. It is a big thing all over the world. We have some voices from right here in Trafalgar Square.
Hi, my name is Marcos Kepper. And yes, we are really every day praying and we are really here hoping that Brazil is going to win again for the sixth time.
My name is Marcelo. I'm from Valadares, Minas Gerais. I hope Brazil win. Yeah, of course. I'm really excited for this World Cup.
My name is Michael. I'm from Brazil, from Vitória Espírito Santo. Well, I think because of the World Cup is happening in Brazil, we expect Brazil to win, of course. And yeah, let's just hope for the best.
Definitely Brazil. I hope, you know, we're going to be there. And yeah, I met my husband 12 years ago on the World Cup when Brazil was champion. So yeah, now we have got 3 kids and, you know, it's always a special day for us and for the world.
My name is Ray. My expectations of the World Cup, I think Brazil will do it this time. After the Confederations Cup, when they beat Spain very easily, 4-0, I think it was. So I believe Brazil will do it.
My name is Eric, and I really hope Brazil does good in the World Cup. I know there are going to be some protests, and there is some expectation of public revolt about the World Cup. But I really hope that the World Cup goes well, and Brazil does succeed and maybe win it.
Gentlemen, off the back of that, I suppose I should ask each of you respectively what you think this World Cup means for your teams. Matthew, I'll start with you.
Well, I've actually never watched a football match fully, properly. I've seen it, you know. But my goodness, for England, it means it's great to see. I mean, as someone who's not into football, it's great to see the passion and the energy. So I suppose it's just, in a way, it's another form of patriotism and love of country. So for Queen and Country, really.
And Phil?
For Australia, it means everything. We're completely and utterly deluded about it, which is wonderful, because Australia is this, you know, sort of far-flung island in the South Pacific. It's kind of oblivious to the fact that no one else knows anything about us and believes that we're terrible at football. We think we're going to waltz into Brazil and win the whole thing. It's superb.
You can get, I've checked, you can get 1,000-1 on Australia on Betfair winning the World Cup.
I put £5 on, so, you know, it's...
And actually quite similar odds on us getting out of that group, which is... Yeah, if we're talking about international conspiracies, I do start to wonder.
I've had a word to Sepp Blatter. He's pliable.
On the subject, we have some thoughts from our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, which are as follows.
Nationalism can be ugly, protective, aggressive towards outsiders, a back turned to the rest of the world. From the muscular nationalism of Narendra Modi in India or Vladimir Putin in Russia to the anguished cry against foreigners from Marine Le Pen in France or Nigel Farage in the UK, 2014 has so far been defined by the worst form of identity politics. Yet as the next 31 days will show, nationalism can also be a thing of beauty. Like nothing else, a World Cup shows us who we are as a nation and broadcasts that story to the rest of the world. The representation of France that takes the field in Porto Alegre on Sunday could not be any further from the dystopian vision of the Front National. Their goals will come from Karim Benzema, a Muslim whose father is Algerian, the creativity from Paul Pogba, born to Guinean parents. France is not alone. The story of Europe at this World Cup will be one of how migration has transformed the continent for the better. Belgium's so-called golden generation includes Romelu Lukaku and Vincent Kompany, both of whom have fathers from Congo, while Marouane Fellaini, whose parents were born in Morocco, will play in the heart of midfield. Switzerland, with its one-time Kosovans, Granit Xhaka and Sherdan Shaqiri, has its best team in modern history. Italy's line will be led by the very Italian-sounding Mario Balotelli, born Ghana. A Germany without its stars with Turkish roots would be less confident of its chances. England too has its migrants and sons of foreigners, and the country will also watch on proudly as dozens of other stars from the English Premier League turn out for Nigeria, Cote d'Ivoire, Australia, Ecuador. The majority of nations, in fact, have players from the land of UKIP. Sadly, Romania failed to qualify. For divided nations, the World Cup will offer respite and a rare chance for unity. Catalans and Basques will star for Spain, Christians and Muslims for Nigeria and Cote d'Ivoire. Financial crises will temporarily be forgotten from Greece to Portugal to Argentina. Discussions about Iranian tactics will refer to 442, not nuclear talks. So wave your flag, belt out your anthem. 11 named people are about to tell the world who you are. For Monocle, I'm Steve Bloomfield.
And on that optimistic note, we will have to leave the first half of Midori House there. Phil Clark from SOAS, Matthew Jameson from RUSI, thank you both very much for joining us. And of course, the Socceroos begin their inexorable march to glory against Chile, I think at about 11 o'clock tomorrow night. 1,000 to 1 strikes me as excellent value as well. Thank you both very much for joining us.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monaco 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
There's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be speaking to our man in Sarajevo, talking also to the author of a book about teams that don't get to the World Cup, and reviewing the week in literature. But before we get started on all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the headlines.
Thank you very much. Ukraine's interior minister has today accused Russia of allowing 3 tanks and other military vehicles to cross the border into eastern Ukraine to help pro-Russian separatists there. Russia did not immediately respond to the accusations. The US says it's ready to help Iraq to tackle the Islamist militants who've now seized control of 2 major cities. President Barack Obama said he's looking at all the options in helping the Iraqi government face down the growing insurgency. Anti-World Cup protesters have clashed with police in Sao Paulo on Thursday, just hours before the opening match of the tournament kicks off. A few dozen protesters clashed with police about 7 miles from the Arena Corinthians Stadium, which will host the Brazil-Croatia opener in 2.5 hours' time at 20:00 GMT tonight. And here, the anarchic British comic actor Rick Mayall, who died suddenly this week, aged just 56, suffered an acute cardiac event at home, his widow has just said today. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. Welcome back to Midori House live here on Monocle 24. It's 21:31 in Moscow, 18:31 here in London, 14:31 in Rio de Janeiro. Time now to check in with one of our many and varied correspondents around the world. And today we're heading to Sarajevo, where Monocle's correspondent Guy Delaunay awaits. Guy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much indeed, Andrew.
First of all, obviously all over Europe there will be commemorations this year of the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the First World War. In Sarajevo, I'm guessing it's a bigger deal than in most places.
Oh yes, it's going to be an absolutely enormous deal. I think you're going to have people coming from all over Europe, if not all over the world, for the commemorations here. Right in the city centre, there's a very large official event planned for the 28th of June, which is the 100th anniversary of the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand by Gavrilo Princip. And there'll be all sorts of performances and commemorations of that event. But it's not going to be the only thing that's happening at that time.
Princip was, of course, a young Bosnian Serb nationalist. How divisive a figure is he now?
Well, this is the thing. He is reasonably divisive. Put it this way, there used to be a bridge over the river which runs through the centre of Sarajevo, which was named Gavrilo Princip Bridge. It isn't called that anymore because the wars which occurred in the 90s resulted in lots of changes, and among those were things like street names and bridge names. So while you'll find lots of Gavrilo Princip streets in Belgrade and Gavrilo Princip schools in Belgrade and other cities around Serbia, you don't find mention of them in parts of Bosnia which are not populated by ethnic Serbs. However, in Sarajevo, in East Sarajevo to be precise, which is in Republika Srpska, the ethnic Serb-dominated part of Bosnia, they are planning to commemorate the event and to put up a statue of Gavrilo Princip in a new park that they're opening. And they're going to do that the day before the official commemorations in the center of Sarajevo.
And how big a deal is that going to be? Is that going to attract protest and reaction from the other side of Sarajevo? We appear to have lost Guy Delaunay. We'll take a short break and we shall return shortly after this.
At the 2014 World Cup in Brazil, these are something we'll be hearing a lot of over the 4 weeks of the tournament. Oh, But what are the alternative national songs that bind the nations taking part in the World Cup together?
There is one song that every South Korean knows, and that is the old folk song Arirang.
We can dissent with our country, but we can be patriotic while doing it.
Monocle 24 brings you a series of special reports on the unofficial anthems that capture the spirit of the 32 nations battling it out in Brazil.
When people come out with some Advance Australia Fair, everybody kind of looks at each other and thinks, what country is that? Whereas if it's Waltzing Matilda, no problem.
That's the World Cup's alternative national anthems throughout the World Cup here on Monocle 24.
We can return now to Guy Delaunay and Sarajevo. Guy, we should move along from history until right now. We were talking about some of the ethnic divisions that beset every aspect of life in Bosnia, and they will beset again the World Cup beginning tonight because Bosnia are going, but Serbia are not.
Correct, and Croatia are to the point, which is going to be very interesting if you're in the west side of the city of Mostar in Bosnia, because the west side is where the ethnic Croats live, and they will be shouting very loudly for Croatia as they take on the hosts Brazil. Of course, as you mentioned, Bosnia are involved, their first match on Sunday against Argentina. Serbia not there this time, so one of the big questions people are asking is, will, in the absence of Serbia, will ethnic Serbs actually shout for Bosnia, the country they live in, the country that most of them were born in? Will they actually shout for this team? And I've been surprised as I've been going around in Sarajevo today. The mayor of East Sarajevo said, well, if Serbia were there, I'd be shouting for them. But no, I will shout for Bosnia this time. And a few other people I met in the sort of Republika Srpska part of Sarajevo have said the same thing. So a lot of people, I think, have been hoping that there'd be some sort of rapprochement or unity brought about by Bosnia's first-time participation in the World Cup, and at least to a small degree, with a very unscientific straw poll, part of it, that does seem to actually be coming to fruition.
Well, they don't appear to have any trouble voting for each other at Eurovision.
They do take their Eurovision quite seriously in this part of the world. You know, the main complaint I get from the government officials in Kosovo is that because of their uncertain international status, they can't participate in Eurovision. I thought they were joking at first, but no, they were deadly serious.
We should move along then to Kosovo, which I think is probably a way off sending a team to a World Cup. Are we looking at the post-Hashim Thaçi era, or maybe not just yet?
Well, it's very interesting. Hashim Thaçi was very quick to declare victory in the election. He's the outgoing prime minister. He was going for a third term in office. He's the leader of the PDK party, former leader, military leader of the Kosovo Liberation Army. But his party didn't really win an overwhelming share of the vote, just over 30%. And he seems to have spoken too soon. A number of other parties have got together, including a couple of defectors from the PDK, who've managed to pass the 5% threshold, thereby guaranteeing seats in Parliament. They say they couldn't scrabble together enough seats to form a governing coalition. And now there's a row whether they've got the right to do so. Hashim Thaçi says more or less, we've got first dibs unless we're voted out in Parliament. So it's an interesting little tussle going on there.
I understand that some people are trying to float the idea of Ramush Haradinaj as a prime minister who has, you could charitably say, a checkered history.
Oh, no kidding, because, of course, Ramush Haradinaj has been up in the Hague a couple of times at the War Crimes Tribunal there, acquitted on both occasions, one has to say. But this is an issue that's not just facing Ramush Haradinaj, whose party got about 10%. In the election. It's facing Hashim Thaçi as well, because in the very near future, we're going to see the results of a very long investigation into alleged war crimes by the Kosovo Liberation Army in the late 1990s, early 2000s, which involved the trafficking of human organs from people who didn't give those organs voluntarily, shall we say. And it's very likely that some extremely high-level figures in the PDK will become roped into that and into a probable tribunal to be held outside of Kosovo.
I visited Kosovo's parliament in Pristina last year and sort of saw Kosovo's government gathered in one place, and it's an extraordinary illustration of what a hold the KLA generation still has on Kosovo. Are there any signs of a subsequent generation of post-war Kosovar politicians?
You know, very little. The main sort of interesting opposition is the Veta Vendosja movement, which is translates as self-determination. They're basically Albanian nationalists, but they've lately become a lot more sort of anti-politics. But their leader, Albin Kurti, was himself a member of the KLA's political wing. You've got another party, the strong party, Partia Forte, who are pretty much political situationists. They go around making pranks and making satire of the whole situation, as you say, that the KLA really do, or, you know, the descendants of the KLA really do still dominate things. We're still at that level at the moment where it's being pointed out the voting levels are going down. It was just over 40% this time round. And people are getting very disillusioned. But at the same time, nobody has yet emerged to enthuse people to vote for an alternative.
Guy Delaunay in Sarajevo, thank you as ever for joining us. Up next, we'll be hearing from James Montagu, author of 31-0, On the Road with Football's Outsiders. Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. On April 11th, 2001, Australia played American Samoa in a World Cup qualifier in Coffs Harbour. Australia, displaying the win-at-all-costs, choked their rivers with dead ruthlessness that has made my country's sportsmen beloved the world over, won the game 31-0, the most monumental thrashing in the history of international football. That scoreline is the title of a hugely entertaining new travelogue by James Montagu. 31-0, On the Road with Football's Outsiders, is a sequence of away days to the world's least likely candidates for World Cup qualification, never mind glory, among them Afghanistan, Palestine, Haiti, San Marino, and of course, American Samoa. I spoke to James earlier. James, did a light bulb go off when you read about the 31-0 game, or did the idea come later?
I guess so. I mean, a light bulb did go off, although the idea for the book was did come a lot later. The light bulb was, it was a game that I became obsessed with. I mean, it was a few years ago that I first heard about it. And, you know, I remember watching the news. It was 10 o'clock news. And then if a football story from, you know, the Pacific comes out on the 10 o'clock news in Britain, you know that something serious has happened or something interesting has happened. And I remember they showed the 31 goals. They didn't show all of them. They showed maybe 10 of them in quick succession. And they showed Nicky Salapu, the goalkeeper, was always on his back or on his face or looking distraught. And I always remember the coach afterwards who said, he gave a brilliant quote. He said, I don't know why they wanted to score so many goals. And for me, ever since I saw it, I tried to find out as much information as possible about the match, about the players, what happened to them, how did it affect them psychologically. And, you know, it wasn't until a lot later that I realised that this was the genesis of, you know, of an idea that I wanted to write about the underdogs, because I'd actually been, as it happened, it turns out that ever since then I'd been writing about the underdogs in world football anyway. And I put it together with an idea after I went to watch Egypt-Algeria in 2009, which was I'm sure you remember this World Cup qualifier, which sparked riots all across the Arab world and also in Europe, in London and Marseille. And it was a hugely political event. And I thought, why not tell the story of World Cup qualification? Because you would tell something of the story of the world over
Indeed.
That period, over that three-year period. But, you know, for me, the most interesting characters, usually the people that didn't make it. Everybody I wrote about always didn't make it to the World Cup finals. So that was my starting point from start to finish, following the teams that somehow pick themselves up, you know, despite losing by cricket scores almost by, you know, every match. And what it said about the world around us, as much as it says about the human spirit.
I do have to return to the 31-0 game. You did go and meet the American Samoans who were vanquished that day. It's a result I recall as an Australian with a certain mixture of pride and embarrassment. How have they coped with it since? Because it is literally, if anybody you meet outside American Samoa knows one thing about American Samoa, it's that they once got hosed 31-0 by Australia. it's literally the only thing I know about American Samoa.
Well, I mean, it's a psychological scar on the players that were involved. And what was interesting is when I went to Samoa, actually, not American Samoa, I went to Samoa, where they had this tournament for World Cup qualification involving American Samoa, Samoa, Cook Islands, and Tonga. And, you know, I went along, and this team, there's only one survivor from that 31-0 defeat, and that was the goalkeeper, Nicky Salapu. And you spoke to him, and it had ruined his life. You know, he worked in a Safeway in Seattle. He was plagued by, like, his workmates would mock him. His kids would get mocked at school. Like, everybody knew that he was the guy that gave up 31 goals. You know, and he, you know, I spoke to the coach, Thomas Rondon. He said, look, if we get anything out of the tournament, it's just, you know, to get the demons off Nicky's back. When I met him, you could tell he was preoccupied by it. It was everything. He told me one coping mechanism that he'd worked out, which was he would play on Xbox, FIFA, and he would play Samoa versus Australia, unplug the second controller, and then score 50 goals. And I'm thinking, if you're doing that 10 years after, mate, I mean, there's some proper damage that maybe you need to see somebody about. And then what happened was, whilst I was with them, they've never won a game since that 31-0 defeat. But then I saw it in Samoa. They won their first ever game after 30 straight World Cup defeats. And he was crying, he was screaming, he was on his knees, and it was catharsis. It was a beautiful, beautiful moment. And, you know, I'm just glad I was there to see it and document it and show people kind of actually how important international football is. And I guess in a little way, kind of how destructive sport can be to somebody's psychological makeup.
You mentioned there that in the importance of international football, and it's something you explore in your sort of, well, you travel all over the world trying to get to the bottom of that. Do you think it's possible that international football, though it's always been important, is actually becoming more so as club football becomes more corporatized?
Well, yes. I mean, there's two ways of looking at it. In one way, one of the reasons why I wanted to write a football, which is kind of, it's an ode, it's a love letter to international football, was because the English in particular have kind of lost their faith in international football. Club football and the corporatism of the Premier League and of the Champions League has kind of separated people from caring more about their club teams and about competing at that higher level, which they see as higher than the World Cup, than being like a tainted organisation or a tainted competition like FIFA and the World Cup. So on one level, I can see how the English have kind of really lost faith in it. But on the other level, you know, you can see outside of England, especially when you look at how important it is in the US at the moment, the booming soccer over there, the national football team and international football is kind of enjoying a kind of boom. But you've got to remember that Americans don't play international sport apart from maybe the Olympics in certain, you know, in track and field events. And, you know, it's very rare for American teams to go and compete in international competition. So although the English are kind of losing faith in it, there's a whole new generation of fans across the world that really are, you know, throwing themselves into what it is.
Going back to the book, which you did put together with some fairly exhaustive travelling around the world's fixtures, just finally and relatively briefly, if you could, because time is unfortunately against us, what was the single strangest fixture you attended?
Wow. I think the strangest fixture was Rwanda versus Eritrea. And it was an African qualifier in Kigali. And Rwanda's a fairly strange place anyway, because obviously the genocide, but nobody talks about the genocide. It's as if the genocide never happened under Kagame's regime. You know, you can't talk about it. Those amputees kind of like ignore them. They don't exist. But what was funny, was actually very tragic, was the Eritrean team who were there. And Eritrea, because people describe it as a North Korea of Africa, such a bad place to live. 50 international footballers had fled whilst on international duty over the past few years. So it was their first away game for 2 years. So I wanted to be there to see if they had used the opportunity, the rare opportunity that they would get for international travel, to escape and find a better life, as dozens of other players had done. And so there was a strange one-eyed kind of football official there who was a former kind of Eritrean guerrilla fighter who kept his other good eye trained on them at all times to make sure they didn't escape. And, you know, he spoke to them and they spoke in a very kind of Stepford Wives kind of everything's great, everything's great, everything is great, Eritrea is great, everything is great. But you could tell something isn't right with these guys. And they all did go home. But then a year later, I found out that most of that team then fled, went on international duty in Uganda, and have just turned up in Holland. So it was a very strange, you know, it was a very strange match, because it wasn't, you know, as interesting as the football was, what was interesting was that you could tell that there was there was shifting sands all around them, and they were indicative of something far wider than being international footballers.
That was James Montague, the author of 31-0 On the Road with Football's Outsiders, speaking to me earlier. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Coming up for 1851, in fact it is right now in London, and it's time for Midori House's nightly review of the best, sometimes the worst, in the worlds of television, cinema, theatre, books, etc. Tonight it is the turn of books, and I'm joined by Fleur MacDonald, editor of The Omnivore and creator of the Hatchet Job of the Year Award. None of those books, I'm assuming, or none of the books you've brought in tonight, I'm assuming, are likely candidates to be on the receiving end of this year's Best Hatchet Job.
No, I don't think so. I mean, they've all had rave reviews so far. Maybe my review will get on then.
Then they're possibly spared. The first book you bought in, this is Andy Miller's A Year of Reading Dangerously. It's a book about books.
Exactly.
Does it work?
Does it work? It depends whether you've read the books that he's talking about or not. And it also depends on whether you buy into him. Whether you're really interested in what someone that's quite average thinks about books. So to explain, so he spends a year reading 50 books on his list of betterments, and he starts with The Master and Margarita. He goes via Middlemarch, then takes a detour with Moby Dick, and then... So
it's basically all those books everybody thinks they probably should have read, but really not many people actually have.
Exactly. And... he hasn't read them because he's very busy, but also, I mean, it's very easy to talk about a book when you haven't read it. I mean, it's sometimes
actually easier in many respects.
Exactly. And he suddenly sort of questions his integrity and feels that he's turning into some kind of drone going to work every day and decides, actually, I'm going to make myself a better person by reading all of these books. I mean, it's a bit like High Fidelity, but... non-fiction and about books.
So does ploughing through the classics, does it make him a happier, better person?
It does. I mean, that's why, in fact, he calls the book A Year of Reading Dangerously, because at the end of it, like with all journeys, he ends up somewhere where he wasn't before, and he decides, well, I don't really want to give it away, actually. I mean, it's nothing huge. He doesn't decide to have a sex change or anything like that. But he just becomes someone that's more aware of what he wants. Which, I mean, it's one... There have been quite a few books recently that have dealt with, you know, what people are reading. So John Kerry did The Unexpected Professor. So he's the Oxford Don. And that's... that he tells his life through books. I mean, there was Hitler's Private Library as well. There was My Life in Middlemarch. But Andy Miller isn't. He's neither John Kerry nor Hitler. And you kind of think...
you can see that quote appearing on the posters.
Yeah. but you kind of think, why am I reading this? I mean, it used to be a blog, but I think the answer is that he was an editor at Faber. So it's always easier to get a book published if you're a former editor.
Indeed. What else have you brought along?
I also read this week another book which caused a furore in the publishing world, Elizabeth is Missing by Emma Healy. And that, I mean, it started a bidding war at London Book Fair. And it's quite easy to see why, actually. It's the sort of thing that throws up so many discussion points that it's going to keep any book group talking.
Proper bidding wars are actually quite unusual in this day and age. What was it about this that publishers thought they could sell?
Debut novelist.
Okay.
She's only 26.
This is starting to annoy me already, but keep going.
That's what I thought. I didn't want to admit it, though. It's actually, I mean, I think that publishers saw something that they could sell, because not only it's a thriller, but it's also a literary novel. So I could see it winning. I mean, if it was a particularly lowbrow year in the Booker Prize, I could see it being... longlisted.
Another quote for the poster right there. potential longlistee in a particularly lowbrow year.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd be happy with that.
But it's totally enjoyable. It's a thriller about a 80-year-old woman that's suffering from dementia. But the only thing that she can remember is that her best friend has disappeared. So she has a mantra, which is Elizabeth is missing. And the whole book is about her attempt to find her friend. But it's also full of flashbacks of when her sister disappeared in the 1940s. So you have two stories running side by side, which it's very interesting. It's a good book.
Okay. You also wanted to talk, I understand, about Elizabeth McCracken's new series, or new collection, rather, which we were just talking there about how proper bidding wars don't happen very often. Neither do collections of short stories, because there is this wisdom among publishers that collections, short stories, anthologies of any sort just don't sell.
I mean, I think that's changing, definitely. So you've got Jennifer Egan, who won the Pulitzer Prize for, I think she did, yeah, the Pulitzer or the National Book Award for A Visit from the Goon Squad. So short story collections are becoming more and more popular. And Elizabeth McCracken's Thunderstruck is amazing. It's great. It actually does what a lot of short story collections are starting to do. There are loads of thematic links and echoes between the stories. So even though you've read...
So they're not completely disconnected from each other.
Exactly. I mean, she's preoccupied by death, so death comes up quite often. But she always treats it... I mean, it's never sentimental. It's always... she always treats it with dark humour. And all of the stories are quite different, but a lot of them deal with grief. She's just... I would really recommend that book.
Okay, and finally, Tara Shane Nisbet's The Wives of Los Alamos, which is... It's an idea that interests me, because much has been written about the Manhattan Project, where the first atomic bomb was built, but obviously most of what has been written has been concerned with the men who built the bomb.
Yes.
Whereas this isn't.
This isn't. I mean, they make fleeting appearances. So Dr. Oppenheimer is described as someone that is tall and rather good looking rather than a great scientist. It's a really interesting book. So it's told not from the perspective of one character, but from all of the women who live there. So it's we the whole time. And so it's kind of like a prose poem, and you basically learn about these women's everyday lives in Los Alamos, which is a desert and it's far from anywhere with huge, lots of security. And it's really beautiful. I read it in one sitting.
That is a recommendation. The Wives of Los Alamos there by Tara Shane Nesbitt. Fleur MacDonald, thank you. That was Fleur MacDonald, editor of Omnivore, and that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our guests at the top of the show, Phil Clark and Matthew Jameson. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alexandra Stenbock-Firmer, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. After the headlines is The Urbanist. At 2200 hours, I'm back with Emma Nelson for The Daily, and indeed I'm back with this show at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.